The fantasy adventure Avatar: The Last Airbender aired on Nickelodeon from 2005 to 2008. But this year, as the pandemic struck, the animated series became one of the biggest streaming hits on Netflix.
In the world of Avatar, some people are essentially equipped with superpowers. They can bend fire, water, earth, or air. Only the Avatar, in this case a 12-year-old boy named Aang, can develop the power to bend all four elements and keep the world in balance. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. Today we are talking about Avatar: The Last Airbender on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, so don't go away.
Some days reading a bunch of headlines just isn't enough. You need to let the news sink in. On Consider This, NPR's new daily news podcast, we can help you do that. Each day, in about 10 minutes, you can find out not just what happened, but why and what it means. Consider This. New episodes every weekday afternoon from NPR.
Welcome back. You just met Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Also joining us today from NPR's Code Switch podcast, Gene Demby. Hello, Gene.
What's good, Joe?
It's so good to have you back. And also here, we have Mallory Yu, movie editor for All Things Considered. Hey, Mallory.
Hey, guys.
Now, before we talk about Avatar: The Last Airbender, we need to make it clear up front that we are inevitably going to spoil some elements of the show's plot. So if you haven't seen it yet, it's a terrific show. Check it out. But if you want to go into it blind, I'd say wait to listen to this episode until you're caught up. So in case you need a quick refresher on the plot, Avatar: The Last Airbender spans a single quest spread out over three seasons of TV. There's a small group of kids. There's Aang. We mentioned him in the intro. There's Katara, who can bend water. There's Katara's wisecracking brother, Sokka, who isn't a bender. And they are joined along the way by Toph, a blind girl who can bend earth. They all travel around the world on a flying bison in an attempt to stop a cruel fire lord named Ozai. He presides over the Fire Nation, which 100 years earlier had committed a genocide against all of the airbenders in an attempt to kill the Avatar. But along the way, Aang got frozen in a glacier for 100 years, and in the first episode, he is newly awakened just as the Fire Nation plots its final quest for world domination. There is a lot going on. Glenn, I'm going to start with you. Give me your initial take on Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Well, let's just take a step back and just appreciate for a second that this show is so good that it single-handedly made a deeply goofy word like bending seem badass. Okay? You hear it so often, it's like, she's a bender. And my favorite thing is, he took my bending. You know, it's just, it's so weird, but it works. And that's the entire appeal of the show, because there's a gentleness to the main character, Aang. There's a gentleness to the show around him. This is not the show for, you know, aggro, mask, adolescent boys, because if they came up with it, it would be like, Avatar: The Last Air Striker, Air Master, Air Puncher. But it's Airbender. It's so much simpler. And that's it. The other thing about the show is that conceptually, it's so satisfyingly simple. Such a brilliant idea to marry different styles of martial arts to different disciplines, to have the four elements used to either dictate or reflect how characters act, who they are, what their personality is, how they move, what their philosophy is. And the animation is really fluid. It really straddles the line between a very traditional, very recognizable American style with a very profound anime influence. It's fascinating to me how much this show wears its influences on its sleeves, not just martial arts stuff, but, you know, anime stylization, and especially in how it deals with spiritual themes and iconography. There's so much Miyazaki in this show. Mm-hmm. And speaking of spirits, in case you were wondering, second time through, the face stealer that he meets in the swamp in one episode is just as much a nightmare fuel as it ever was. Terrifying. I love this show. I can't wait to go back and watch it again.
How about you, Mallory?
I love this show. It's hard for me to talk about it in a coherent way because I love it so much and I just get so excited about it. Glenn, like you were saying, the creature design in this show is so good. Uh-huh. I mean, really cute, like turtle ducks and Momo the lemur and Appa the flying bison. I mean, these are creatures that are really cute and cuddly and definitely made for kids to want a stuffed animal. And then you have the face stealer and you have the kind of design of the Fire Nation and their ships. I mean, every sort of detail in this show really expresses a love for kung fu and for martial arts, for East Asian culture. There's just so much in it that I related to and respect. It's fun and goofy too, and it can be really complex and emotional and then make you laugh in a second because of a goofy joke. There's a lot of good humor and the characters all relate well to each other. And the first time I watched it with my brother, who's 4 years younger, we both looked at each other and we're like, oh my God, we're Sokka and Katara. Like, that is how we interact with each other. So there's just so much for kids and for everyone. And I'm so excited to be talking about this show.
So that is another check in the pro column, I would say. Let's see if Gene feels the same way. Gene, how do you feel about Avatar: The Last Airbender?
Furious cosigns. This is, I think, watching it during the pandemic was like my sixth watch through, all the way through. And when I was like 25 or 26, I think it was when it first dropped. And I didn't actually watch it when it first dropped, but I watched it like after 2008, after the entire run. And I was like, why is everyone talking about this show? And I was very cognizant of the fact that I was a whole ass adult at the time. And it was like very much pitched to the Nickelodeon audience. And I remember being so embarrassed at the time by how much I liked that show. I was like, oh my God, I want to talk about this show with somebody. I don't think it's hyperbole to say like it is one of the best shows of the last 20 years, like animated or otherwise. Mm-hmm. It has so much going on. It's so coherent, right? Like there aren't a lot of filler episodes. It doesn't feel like there's not a lot of flotsam in it. The world building is so expertly done. Like by the time you get to the second season, all of the sort of physics of the world makes sense. Like they're really legible to you. All the motivations of the individual characters are really legible, even as those motivations are shifting. There's just so much dope stuff happening in the show. And it's funny because, of course, the show sort of became my entry into things like Miyazaki. Like, Appa is obviously the cat bus from My Neighbor Totoro. I was like, okay, let's go watch that, right? There's just so much happening in this show that's so thoughtful and so masterfully done. And when I was watching with my wife, because she had never seen it, she was like, oh, I've never seen the show that everyone's talking about. I was like, oh, guess what we're doing for the next 2 weeks? And we, like, powered through it. I will watch the show as many times as I possibly can. I bought it a couple of years ago. I mean, it's just like one of my favorite pieces of pop culture in the last 20 years or so.
Okay, well, all right, it's my turn. I like it. I didn't watch this show until it was on Netflix. It just dropped on Netflix in May. My 19-year-old son is obsessed with it and loves it, and The Legend of Korra, which is its sequel series. And he had been so eager to sit me down and just like watch episode by episode. I think just spent the entire time just like watching my reaction to see if I loved it as much as he did. And I do. I think this is a wonderful and beautiful show. I think it is fascinating how simple this show and how convoluted this show is at the same time. That when we're talking about it, it's like, well, a group of kids goes on a quest to defeat evil. Like that's the kind of short answer. But then if you heard kind of the introduction where I was unspooling, like there's this person and this person and this person. We haven't even mentioned Prince Zuko and his uncle Iroh, who is one of my favorite characters in animation. There are a lot of characters doing a lot of things and each character has not only an arc, but a growth pattern. And so the levels of complexity, at one point, they journey into the city of Ba Sing Se, and you're suddenly thrust into the unique politics of this city that the show has put such thought into. You can also just go deeper and talk about it, as I know Gene wants to, for hours and hours and hours. I was really struck, talking about the visual elements of this show, I was struck really early on. If you were to go to the San Diego Comic-Con with a group of your friends and dress as the characters of this show, you could, for very little money and very little imagination, render yourself instantly identifiable as each character on this show. And at the same time, there are all these subtleties to it. The way that the residents of each nation have a different eye color is one of those things I did not even notice after plowing through both of these shows in their entirety. And my son was walking me through all these things that he had noticed. I love this show. Now, when we were preparing to do this segment, we did a call out. You know, we asked listeners, you know, we know some of you are as obsessed with this show as one Gene Demby. Why don't you send us, you know, a voice memo asking us some questions about it? So let's hit the first one.
Hey, my name is Brianna. I'm from New York. As you're watching the shows now, what are some things that you're noticing that you didn't notice the first time you watched it?
All right, well, that is a question for Gene and Mallory, who had seen it before we were prepping for this show.
I think the thing that I've been noticing now, rewatching the show, that I didn't notice before was the relationship between Prince Zuko and his uncle Iroh. So Zuko is the Fire Nation prince who is banished from his home kingdom, and he's trying to recapture the Avatar to restore his honor. And Iroh is sort of his gentle, tea-loving, music-playing uncle who sort of follows him on this journey. And when I was a kid, I really related to Zuko and his sort of punch first, think later mentality because of his fear of failure. And Iroh being sort of the voice of calm and telling Zuko, no, let's drink a cup of tea and think about this. Let's sing a song with our colleagues or our co-warriors or whatever. And now as an adult, I find myself really appreciating Iroh's gentility and his sort of going with the flow attitude. And yet when Iroh is called to action, when he needs to get down, he is there. He is there for his country, and mostly he is there for Zuko. Mm-hmm. And I just love the idea of this like gentle father figure in the middle of a war guiding this young man to emotional growth, and not just emotional growth, but growth in his power and his like sense of self and his growing enough to kind of carry the weight of leading a better version of the Fire Nation.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you completely, Mallory, that he is crucial. How about you, Gene?
One of the things that jumped out to me was Aang is obviously the principal character. The show sort of starts off with like, okay, he's a young kid. He is happy-go-lucky. He's trying to, you know, just have a good time. They're trying to pull him towards their responsibilities. And he's like, nah, I want to just kick it and have fun and do all this stuff, even though I know I eventually have to do this big thing. As the show goes on, I guess, and maybe this is because I've been going to therapy for the last couple of years, but one of the things that jumps out to me was how much, like, they really write Aang as an avoidant person, right? Like, there are all these things in front of him that he is actively trying to not deal with, right? Because, you know, he feels all this obviously tremendous guilt because he's the lone survivor of this genocide. It resonated with me so much more this time around, whereas like when Toph is trying to teach him how to earthbend, right? And she's like, the thing you have to do is face the thing head on, right? She's like, you can't dance around it. You can't avoid it. All the things that you are inclined to do because this is who you are, this is not going to help you through this thing. And it just like, it just sounded so much like a session with my therapist. I was like, oh my God. It was like, oh my, this show is written for 10-year-olds, you know? Zuko's maturation is much more obvious, right? But I think Aang sort of goes from this childlike person to a person who's much more responsible and older and also still has that sort of like goodwill, right? Still in him, even as he is learning to take on more responsibility. I just thought that was like a really, really smart thing that I appreciated more, you know, 15 years out.
All right, let's get another question.
Hey guys, this is Max. Do you think it was helpful to the show to be on Nickelodeon? Or should it have been on something like Adult Swim where they could have had license to do all kinds of crazy, mature content? I'm inclined to think that Avatar was better the way it was and that Korra was sort of a middle ground. Anyway, love to hear what you guys think.
I'll actually kick this one off because I had this thought several times watching the show that I was so glad it was on Nickelodeon because it allowed them to be kind of more imaginative and thoughtful about every piece of violence. It's so appropriate to the character of Aang to approach its violence that way. If this story were in the hands of Joss Whedon and these characters rounded up these characters, those characters would have been wiped out completely. And that would have provided some of the emotional stakes for the characters going forward. The fact that this show is much more judicious in its like permanent consequences of violence, I think really works for it and really fits with its themes really well.
I totally agree with that, Stephen. I think that this show wouldn't have been the same if it had been on, say, a more quote-unquote mature or adult network. The beauty of this show, for me, the thing that makes it so good and so pure is that it is a kids' show, that it is aimed for kids. Like these big concepts, the complexity of what it means to hold power, of fear and anger and resentment and the toxicity of those emotions, there's still sort of a genuine and childlike joy that I think is really important for adults to remember, that kids have the ability to sort of, and the flexibility to ping pong between these complex emotions which they might not have words to explain, and the show is sort of showing kids how to work through some of those emotions. It doesn't talk down to kids, and it expects that children are able to understand and comprehend, you know, these really adult concepts if they are presented to them in a way that kids can relate to. So every single character learns something new every single episode, and that something new enhances and snowballs into character growth. And, you know, Aang goes from early in the series, he goes from calling himself just one kid to being someone who is powerful and can make change. And I think it's really important to show children that they are just one kid, but they could grow up to hold this power. And what does it mean to hold that power?
Exactly. What it's doing by constantly focusing on the relationships between these characters is it knows that it can deal in the world of the metaphorical language of spirituality and emotion. So it's about emotional stakes and spiritual stakes, not physical stakes. The physical stakes come in as kind of an afterthought. It's really, it has a different focus. When we talk about Korra, we'll talk more about how that is a show that works in shades of gray more than this one does. And it has a different set of emotional stakes. But yeah, that's what the show really does well.
So let's get another question.
Hey, PCHH, my name is Koshi. If y'all could bend an element, which element do you think you guys would bend? Thanks.
I mean, everybody's going to say water, right? Water is the only answer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Water is life.
It's the most useful and most... Yeah, that's right.
I mean, there's no disagreement.
First of all, like, over the course of this series, and then especially in The Legend of Korra, they start to provide twists on these things that complicate matters. If you're just looking at the basics of earth, air, water, fire, I agree. Water has that combination liquid-solid thing that allows you to do a lot of the same things that the other elements can do. So I do think water is probably the right answer. As much as fire is presented as terrifying and the villains of Avatar The Last Airbender are firebenders, the way it manifests in battle tends to be poof, poof, poof.
That's true.
Instead of having like quite the like really lushly three-dimensional motion that the other elements have, fire really is this kind of blurt. It's almost like it hits like a fist instead of having these like different properties to it. I agree. I think it's water.
Do we all agree here that of the four elements, at least as it's presented in Avatar, that earthbending is kind of the Ringo, the Charlotte, the Hufflepuff, right? We all agree? I mean, you get to some fancy stuff later, but just out of the four of them, right?
I mean,
yes?
It's the tankiest,
which
is just like kind of whomping on something. I can see a real upside to earthbending. I don't think it's the Shemp or whatever you're suggesting.
It's more like the Thing of Fantastic Four, right? It's like the sort of brute force.
All right, any quick closing thoughts? I think it's safe to say we are all fans.
We're all fans. I would just say this, that this show did not have to map its entire world on top of Asianography and customs. They could have just started from scratch and kept the whole element stuff. You could argue that by doing so, it lends some substance to it, some weight to it. You could also argue that it's cultural appropriation, especially given how Lily White the voice cast is. But I do think it is done respectfully. There's an episode where we get a guided tour of the seven chakras straight out of Hindu tantrism, mapped one for one. And it's not like, oh, another training montage. The first chakra is X, and then we cut. By the time it was like, the fifth chakra is about, I was like, oh, we're doing this. We're going all the way through. And it's so respectful and sincere, and it is about serving the story as opposed to being window dressing. And that's something that, at least for me, is one of the reasons it doesn't feel fake.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there are so many sort of tiny homages to, you know, shots that you might see in a kung fu movie. There are side-by-side comparisons that you can make between different styles of martial arts with firebending, airbending, waterbending, earthbending. It imagines a fantasy that is not all white. And I think that in itself is a really remarkable feat, that it shows you can do fantasy and real, like, high concept fantasy with non-white, non-European cultures. I think it's like also part of the dress that characters wear, from, you know, the nobility of the Fire Nation to the sort of more earthy, for lack of a better word, clothes that the earthbenders wear. I mean, there are so many details in this that make you really think that there is genuine love and understanding of the importance of spiritual aspects to Asian people.
I just think that Azula is like a specific sort of accomplishment in the show. They wrote a character in the kids show that is legitimately terrifying, like, and not like terrifying in the way that some of the monsters are, terrifying in this like, oh, this person is ruthless and maybe a sociopath in a way that is like legible to children. I mean, villains are usually written as hapless and eventually, like, you know, maybe really powerful, but also really stupid. Azula is actually this very formidable and legitimately scary antagonist for, you know, the Aang gang to go up against. I've never seen a bad guy written quite as well as she was written in a show for kids.
Yeah, she's legit terrifying and a very different kind of bad guy. I guess my kind of final thoughts on this show is I just think it's so refreshing to watch a hit show, a show that people loved, that was very well received when it aired, and they wrote three seasons. They wrote a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end that is three seasons, roughly 60 episodes long, and when it ends, it ends. And at the same time, like, leaving space for not only a sequel series, but a whole bunch of graphic novels. But the way that they told this story, when it's over, it feels complete. And I found that really refreshing in an era where so many properties kind of never end. Well, obviously, we all love Avatar The Last Airbender, but we want to know what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to all of you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here on Friday.